It's kind of this political debate around what's better. And I simply think it's missing the point, because you can build high-performing teams in both worlds, but it's the context, it's the culture, it's the tools that you're using. It's just a message I would like to relay, because what's happening these days, I find generally useless.
From Tuple, this is Distributed, where we show how world-class engineers and their teams tackle the challenges of remote work. I'm Jack Hanna, your host. Let's get to the real work.
Today, I'm talking to Ben Grobiel, who's a staff engineer at Sneak, having recently transitioned from a senior engineering manager role where Ben led two platform teams. Ben, you have almost 15 years of experience, including time spent as the CTO of a 40-person startup. You've served in IC roles. You even ran a full-stack web dev shop, I think, before graduating university. We're going to cover your transition from manager to staff engineer, some of the habits, practices, rituals, the stuff that's allowed you to have the success that you have today, as well as what it takes to start really effective engineering teams. Could you give us a brief breakdown of your journey as a software developer from the early days running a web dev shop?
It all started with a passion for computer games, to be honest. I think that was school time and getting into computers, and then one thing led to another. You start building simple HTML pages and teamed up with a friend, and we started building websites for customers, first for free and then suddenly got paid for it. We did that for like 10 years alongside uni, as you said. After that, I started with a consultancy, and after doing that for a year or so, I realized I would like to be closer to products. And then I joined Pivotal, which is a really key part in my career because it introduced me to extreme programming. That kind of, you know, opened my mind to software methodologies and a really great developer culture. But then once again, I kind of felt, now I really want to go into product development. I was working on products, but still products for customers. And I just wanted to see more longevity of my work and how it pans out in the long run. And two friends of mine came knocking because one of them landed a job at the startup and we could be the founding engineers. And that was an offer too good to refuse. And we jumped on, built an engineering team of about 15, which was the point where I got the CTO seat. And yeah, that kind of really opened my eyes towards how technology companies are run, represented at boards. And then after that, I went back into an IC role and then hopped onto Sneak and you did 3 years of engineering management. And here I am.
I think so many folks have it in their head that they have to go down a linear path, right? Like, I'm going to be a senior principal engineer someday. I'm just going to do that. Or, hey, I want to someday be CTO and I'm just going to do that. But I think the reality is a lot of folks bounce back and forth between the two. Before we talk about that, when you were leading two platform teams as a senior engineering manager at Sneak, what was that setup?
There were two teams, so 15 reports in total, all remote. New hires were kind of more office-based, but the teams themselves were distributed across Europe. We were running kind of really essential infrastructure that kind of powers the analysis of customer assets.
What inspired the switch to the staff role?
It's a combination of things. Number one is I felt that I'm losing my technical axe, as I call it. It's the kind of the sharpness in my engineering thinking. And when you're rooted in people problems 2.5, 3 days of the week, it just absorbs you. And it's really difficult to then use the remaining bits on highly technical problems. And I kind of missed that. I missed solving problems more like to the wire. And I mean, you solve a lot of problems as an engineering manager. You just solve them through people. But I kind of missed the action a little bit. So that was one part. And then the other part was just managing more than 5 people for me is after doing it for like a year and a half, it was just too much. It was too much kind of admin work that came with it. And, you know, looking after the growth of 15 people and taking that seriously is, I found, too taxing.
What was the hardest part about that?
There's a big degree of repetition. Imagine doing 15 one-on-ones. We usually have weekly one-on-ones. And it's really trivial things like, in order to be an authentic leader, you want to share, I mean, apart from being a great listener and asking questions, you also need to give something from you and like be approachable and tell people something about you here and then. And you end up just repeating what you did on the weekend 15 times, right? And so it's trivial things like that where there's a lot of repetition that comes with it. And then when more formal processes kick in, like salary negotiations or review periods and so on, like writing good reviews that are well-researched, calibrated with peers, it just takes a ton of time.
Yeah. How has it felt coming back to the other side?
Really refreshing in terms of having a much leaner calendar. That's like having time to think about problems. It's a real privilege, I now realize. It's a good swing. At the end of the day, my day-to-day has changed quite a bit, but at the same time, there's also a ton of overlap between these roles. Like any kind of project, as soon as you're doing project work and you do that as an EM and you do that as an IC, yeah, they're also very, very similar, which I guess speaks to your point about A, there's an overlap, and B, it's enriching perspectives. It's good to know all perspectives in ideal world of successful projects, and then you can kind of fill the gaps easier.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk a little bit about what your role looks like as a staff engineer today. Like, how big is your current team, and what does a typical day look like for you now?
So I work for a scale up. It's like, 500 engineers, roughly. Massive growth in the past years, and now kind of paying back debt and while still developing features at the same time. So a ton of kind of exciting, challenging problems under quite a lot of pressure. And one of the roles that are kind of required here is leading bigger projects that span across the entire organization. So you have, cross-team collaboration is notoriously difficult, especially in kind of environments where maybe you do not have the perfectly crafted domains yet. You know, they're emerging and things are always changing. So it's really coming up with technical plans for features that kind of hold water and then executing them across usually 5 to 10 teams.
What are some of the characteristics of the most effective teams that you've been exposed to or been a part of?
One of the things that always comes to mind here is kind of feedback loops. It's how information flows, which, by the way, is, I guess, why I'm such a big fan of Tuple. But like, if you can encourage team or multiple teams to share information effectively, that's usually a winning formula. It leads to better decisions. It leads to less misunderstandings. And I think these are really just the key pillars. So feedback loops at every level. In product, that's kind of the build, learn, measure, lean kind of approach. In engineering, that means TDD, for example, feedback loop between implementation and code and like whether it works or not. You have pairing, again, an amazing feedback loop mechanism. And you have retros, good processes play into it. If I had to summarize it, if one can establish feedback loops at the key parts of the structure, then that is a good proxy for success.
How do you go about doing that? Like, what are those key moments and what do you do to make sure that those feedback loops are in place?
Process plays a big part. It starts with simple things like, okay, once a day we meet, stand up. By the way, I caveat here, I'm biased towards, I'm a big fan of remote work, but I'm also a big fan of kind of synchronous work. Because in my opinion, it helps. It's just a faster feedback loop than writing something down and someone else picking it up 8 hours later and then responding. Anyway, I guess how you do it is kind of the process that you follow. It starts with stand-ups, with retros, with regular check-ins, with socials, where just you make sure people talk. And as an EM, you have, I think, there's a responsibility on you to really facilitate that if it's not happening. And as an IC, usually the top performers are the ones that are able to kind of very effectively participate and even facilitate this kind of collaboration as well.
Are there any of those rituals or habits that you feel like you have a formula for that you feel really proud of?
When pairing, at the end of the pairing session, you do a quick feedback round. Like, what went well today? What could we do different next time? And use this moment to share feedback also about the approach and how, on the meta level, how did we collaborate? Did I grab the keyboard once when you were driving and you had an idea and I was too dominant or I was too quiet? It's like these refinements, if you do them consistently, that's what drives performance, kind of consistent improvement. I mean, another thing is speedbacks. Like, you know, once a quarter, my teams come together and we do every person talking to every other person in the team kind of thing. And within 7 minutes, just pass face-to-face feedback in an informal way. It's not captured in the performance review. It's really, this is to do with building high-performing teams and giving people a chance to learn. It's a growth thing at the end of the day. So it's really, these are small tweaks that every time they happen, I'm surprised that if you do them consistently, they really drive good results.
I want to actually dig into both of those things because I think it's going to be sound and feel a little tactical, but I think there's some really interesting stuff here to unpack. Speedbacks. I've never heard this term before. Could you just break this down, this process? How often do you do it? What exactly does it look like? Imagine you're telling somebody else because they want to implement this process. Maybe they're listening in the audience and this is something they're curious about. What does that look like?
Every 3 or 4 months, team comes together and we remind the team of the importance and the gift of feedback and how good feedback looks like. Good feedback is actionable, it's kind, it's honest. And with that kind of mindset, people are tasked to think about every other person on the team, about what are things they do well and about what could they do differently, better, in another way. So like constructive feedback at the end of the day.
Sure.
And we would then have a meeting, usually takes an hour or an hour and a half, depending on team size. And as a facilitator, I make sure that we have breakout rooms where each person talks to the other person. Actually, we have a little, a friend of mine has written a little little app that will give you all the combinations, because I can tell you it gets really confusing very quickly because it's combinatorial explosions. I just make sure everyone talks to everyone. And within these conversations, each person gets 3.5 minutes and they talk about the feedback they have. And it goes both ways. So one person starts and the other person listens and then we turn around. The idea is not to have a debate. And that goes into the intro of feedback, right? That's like, it's a gift. We listen and then we take things in. This is not the moment to go and debate. This is the moment to spark a conversation down the road. So you don't want to resolve any kind of conflicts in these meetings. These are safe environments to just pass some feedback and then take action outside of the meeting itself. So that's where the speed comes in.
So the point is basically to give and receive. You can kind of like process thereafter and engage with it more deeply if appropriate. But this is really about that exchange and having happen rapidly between everyone on the team.
Yes. And the beauty here is that you don't need massive sessions where like people talk for ages and you debate feedback back and forth. In fact, it's quite the opposite. You do it frequently and in a shorter fashion, a bit like TDD, you know. It's kind of that you do it often and you have quick turnaround. And that's, I think, part of the success of this format. It doesn't take a lot to prepare and it doesn't take a lot to just listen and absorb.
So you do that every like three, 4 months, it sounds like. And that's coupled with this other practice that at the end of each pairing session, you have sort of like a meta retro or feedback session on how did we work together in service of what we were trying to accomplish. And so it's about the teamwork. It's about the communication and the collaboration. And you do that at the end of each pairing session. Did I understand that right?
Yes, that's exactly the idea. Whether it happens at the end of every pairing session, most likely not. As an EM, you kind of hear these stories about this person. I'm not getting along. When they write code, it's like their thinking is convoluted, this and that, right? And then you're in that seat of, okay, what do I do with this feedback? Between them two, they're not able to have fun pairing. And I think this practice is one of the ways where, you create a safe space where it's like you announce it, you know it's coming. You know, at the end of the session as a practice, you just reflect and you're open, you listen, and together you try to describe what happened this afternoon, right? And it's just one of these mechanisms that you can use as an EM to kind of foster information flow at the end and help two people get closer or discuss some potentially conflictive opinions.
I always find that to be one of the hardest part about being a manager is people come to you with their issues that they have not communicated to the other person. And you're just sort of like, well, hold on, have you told the other person yet that this is how you feel? And the answer is always, well, no, that's why I'm talking to you. And it's like, okay, well, first step might be to figure out how to communicate this effectively to them and then coaching them through that process. And, you know, I say that in sort of a joking way. I don't mean to make it sound like it's easy to always be vulnerable and sharing how you feel about some interaction.
Not sure. Yeah.
But if you create it as a practice, as a habit, as a ritual that happens, maybe not every time, but more often than not, that can be pretty productive. And I would bet that if you're an IC asking to do that, and I would probably ask at the beginning of a session rather than the end, like, hey, at the end of the session, can we do this thing? I bet that's probably pretty effective too.
100%. Yeah. Another thing I believe in of kind of high performing teams, you know, you have all ranks essentially in your team, and you also in ideal world have your designer and your product manager, your fully functional team. But you really want to make sure that the more senior someone gets, the more feedback they can get. And for, say, less experienced people, it's very often intimidating to just give feedback. Like, they wouldn't just call someone and say, hey, today I just want to tell you something. That really pissed me off. Like, oh, you treat me like an idiot, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
And with processes like that, there's like a structure that everyone can use, and it benefits everyone on the team, no matter the rank. And yeah, the more senior you are, the more responsibility you have to actually make these feedback sessions constructive.
So you talked about functional teams very briefly. Could you comment on why you value a functional team? Like, what you see is the value of having all of those folks nestled together?
To me, in essence, it makes for better decision-making. It's like, what feature should you build? How should it look like? How do you build it? Is a joint effort between engineering, product, and design. Some features even need marketing. So yeah, marketing into the mix, or data science and kind of reporting. You want all perspectives to come together. I think it leads to better product outcomes and therefore better business outcomes. It's something that really needs to be part of the culture and the DNA. You can't really do these things bottom up without support.
I want to shift gears back to some of the high performance stuff that we were talking about. Could you tell me about a particular project or a team that you worked on where you felt like the team was really firing on all cylinders?
One of them is the startup myself and my two friends were founding engineers for. We hired the crew. The interview process was kind of tailored towards our culture of collaboration and technical level. And that kind of led to people joining the team that would just gel with the way we operated. And we, you know, that back in the days, it was pairing every day, all day long. So a pretty extreme way implementation of it. And in addition to that, there was a really strong sense of mission, the kind of building software for a business. And like, what that business did was like educational videos, making the world a better place. It's just a few things came together there, like really great people, a culture that was built from ground up and kind of resonated, and then a strong mission statement, and also a few practices and technical innovations that kind of helped us as well.
Yeah, what were some of those technical innovations?
On the kind of methodology side, we started really using DDD, domain-driven design, and that was kind of an eye-opener for many because of the just having a ubiquitous language, talking about business problems in code. It just creates a really great understanding of what the business does and what the code does. And that was really key in any kind of communication, any kind of problem solving. You knew exactly. You could navigate the code really easily if you understood the business. On the technology side, it was early days of Kubernetes. So like just new ways of deploying your software and owning the full vertical. Gave us great flexibility of deploying our apps, running workloads, deploying bigger pieces in our cluster, like tooling in our cluster. That was a part of it. And then I guess front-end wise, it was still fairly early days of React, which we heavily leveraged, Kotlin. All these things have been around before, but it just came for us. It was like we were able to pick whatever we thought was the right tool at the time, and that then together created a really productive technological landscape that would allow us to iterate quickly.
Were you making a bunch of those calls as CTO?
I mean, as CTO, as a team. But yeah, given that the three of us started as founding engineers, we were able to kind of just bring the technology that we thought was sensible.
What did that feel like to be able to make all those calls coming from a world where I think you were, you know, in the consulting world and then sort of contracted out at Pivotal to do work on behalf of other companies? I'm assuming you had much less agency in those situations to make decisions about the technology stack than you did at the startup. So what did it feel like to finally have that chance to dictate what's the tech stack we're going to use and how are we going to go about executing against it?
Both freeing and unnerving, because you can choose whatever you like. There's no one in the company that can truly challenge you. At the same time, the responsibility is on you to choose the right thing. I find that a really exciting mix of looking at a problem holistically and figuring out what option is the best. Like, there's trade-offs wherever you look, but yeah, I guess that was at the end of the day very exciting.
In retrospect, you get any of those judgments wrong?
I mean, you could argue with say Kubernetes, and in the short, with Kubernetes, for example, back in the days, there's like there was quite a lot of DevOps work that, like, for a small startup, you don't want to shoulder. A PaaS solution would be, I don't know, Heroku kind of grade thing would have done as well. And we always debated, like, yeah, was that the right call? But in the long run, it was, because again, it kind of led us towards, okay, now we can deploy Spark in our cluster. Now we can suddenly, instead of buying everything off the shelf, actually, there's a point where you buy so many things, it becomes quite expensive, and actually running them at a fairly small scale isn't that expensive. Mm-hmm. So I think it was the right call in the long run, but certainly in the first year or so, I think, diving deep into Kubernetes operators and so on when you're trying to ship a business, like a new feature, felt a little bit off.
Well, it's stressful working at a startup where, in a role like the role that you're in, so much of the responsibility lives and dies with your decisions and your ability to execute against them.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And you're really on the hook, as you say. It's like you make a call. If the team comes to a halt because you made the wrong calls, I mean, that's a reason to be fired for good reasons. Autonomy and accountability at the end of the day. These are, by the way, also things I would add to the high-performing team. But I think these are really two key ingredients here that make it exciting.
Yeah, no doubt. I get an immense amount of motivation for me personally of living and dying by my own sword. There's something, there's a certain sadistic thrill in knowing that if I mess this up, I'm going to be totally fired. That like really gets me going.
It's so true. It's so true.
Well, at the beginning, you were talking a little bit about the context at Sneak. It's a scale-up for 500 engineers. You know, you've been building like crazy for so many years, growing really quickly, and now you have to continue to grow really quickly while paying off the technical debt. And I think through this experience, you've had the chance to start a couple of the teams that you've managed. And you did that having had the experience of complete autonomy at the startup where you could make all of the judgments. Talk to me a little bit about one of the teams that you actually started and formed at Sneak and what that experience was like.
The very first team I was on, I bootstrapped. So I was the first engineer and we were working the billing space, really bringing kind of self-serve experience to Sneak. And yeah, it's a really different problem. You do hiring, constant hiring. You have lots of interviews. You try to get the right people on the bus. You try to find people inside Sneak or inside your organization that already have context, that are kind of looking for a switch and so on. I was successful at that. And then you start building the mission. And every time someone joins, there's this moment of you have to go back to the drawing board because people have to be bought in, right? It took about a year of exactly that, hiring, starting to build out a mission, starting to build working software. And every time someone joins, it's an opportunity to kind of refine what you're doing and also to delegate to others selling the mission. And that's then a really great tool where you don't have to do it anymore, but also someone else starts to really buy into it because now they are pitching to the next person about why we do it and hear the plans and like, I own this feature, I own that. So yeah, I guess that's the kind of the motion you go through of starting single person, getting people, forming a mission, starting a backlog, and then delegating to others as more people join to kind of replicate that.
And when you did that at Sneak, was the team remote? Was it hybrid?
The startup experience was kind of half-half. We started in person for like a year and a half, and then we opened a branch and an office in Poland. But that at that point, we were kind of pairing across Europe. But yeah, this was entirely remote, and it happened during a high growth period. So remote, as in we were working across the pond. We had people in Canada, people in the UK. But yeah, that was kind of an interesting experience with kind of different levels of experience and time zone differences. And there is definitely a recipe for challenges in that combination.
Tell me more.
It happened to be that we had kind of all the seniority in the UK, and we hired, I think, two associates in Canada with like a 6-7 hour or 5-6 hour time zone difference. And leveraging pairing, it's just everything becomes tricky. You have an overlap of like 3-4 hours. You have experience gaps that you need to cover and address. In those 2-3 hours, it's also when all the meetings happen. So to actually help people grow and like help less experienced people to be successful, there is very little time, or you need new means and ways to do that. You can't rely on synchronous pairing only. That's where, for me, all the context is so critical. If like a senior bunch, everyone knows exactly what they're doing, and very small team, not many meetings, that can absolutely work. You have 3-4 hours of pairing a day, which is plenty. Like remote pairing, 3-4 hours tires you out big time. It's like perfect. But if you have like a growing team, redefining missions, big experience gaps, at that point, the more overlap you have, the better.
Definitely some inherent differences between working remote, working hybrid, and working in person. But the context that surrounds that situation also makes a pretty big difference. You know, the seniority level, the stage of the team's development, how long you've been working together, et cetera. Could you talk a little bit about how you think about the differences between these different types of setups, in-person, remote, hybrid, what have you?
Very, very timely, because there's so much political debate going on about these kind of different ways of working. And at the end of the day, every way of working wants the same. It wants a highly productive, a high-performing team of teams, right? That's what everyone is after. To me, so that's what's similar between all of them. They all have the same kind of overarching objective. What's different to me is more like just how you achieve that, and less so a discussion of which one, like what is one better than the other. I believe all three variations can be equally successful. But to your point before, I think it really depends on the context that you're operating in, and also to what extent you can shape that context. Like, have you hired people that do not want to work remotely, and now they're forced to work remotely, and they fundamentally don't like it, and maybe they're not as good at it? If you can't change that, I think you shouldn't consider remote. You should go back to the office as soon as you can. But if you have hired remote people and they are high performing, then why would you force them back? Like, objectively speaking, where's the problem there? So it's, I guess they're similar in many ways. They're just very different in the approach of how you get there.
What do you think are some of the things that are most important to get right if your team is remote?
I think really just making sure information flows, information reaches people. And I think if you have that in place, it means you can make good decisions. If you make good decisions, you're winning the game, right? To me, it comes back to information flow. And then this, of course, will branch out into, do you have the right people that understand this and can help the information flow? Do you have the right culture that kind of encourages a transparent and helpful flow of information? Do you have the right leadership that knows how to kind of facilitate this information flow across all hierarchy levels? And this really goes all the way to the CEO. Like, there needs to be awareness that we are a distributed remote team and that information needs to be shared in certain ways. You can't rely on just rumors spreading in the office, or like, you know, rocking up in a meeting room, getting everyone together and just high bandwidth, quickly telling people what's happening.
Do you think that stuff inherently happens when you're in person?
No. I think it's easier. It gives you the illusion of it's happening, you know, all hands, big 100, 200 people in a big seating area. And I think it makes it tangible, but I think it's an illusion that it's more effective.
You talked about pairing as one of the things that you do to encourage information flow. If you were to name one or two other things that you think about really help drive the flow of information, what comes to mind?
Any kind of objective framework, OKRs or any of the like. I think just having clarity around what's expected from different parts of the organization is, again, this is true for both worlds, but I think it's just one of these things that can really help information to flow in a constructive fashion, because it's objective. It's like, hey, here's what I'm trying to optimize, here's where I'm standing today, and this is a problem because whatever. Clarity around where you're going in terms of objectives, rituals, but again, rituals, they can largely overlap. You can do stand-up in person, you can do stand-up online, doesn't really matter. But offsites, I think it's a very dangerous strategy to have a remote team, but not the budget for kind of supporting a remote workforce. Because I cannot deny the value of, I don't know, once a year, or two or three times a year, meeting people in person and having these high bandwidth moments. I think that's invaluable.
Invaluable how? Like what value does it deliver?
It's valuable for, number one, bonding. I think at the end, they were all human, and meeting people in person occasionally just adds that human touch. So yeah, you get time to informally chat about things. You get a feeling, you just get a different dimension of a person. I think that's just useful for teams generally. And then also you get this kind of the ritual side of things, or say kicking off big work, you know, say, hey, you know, you remember that moment, you know, handshake, we agreed and we disagreed first, but then we went for it. We came out with a plan. And it's these memories that can live for a long time and actually have a quite deep impact on people.
Bringing everybody together in key moments, either the kickoff of a given project or a given time period, or when new team members join, giving folks the opportunity to get together. I'm wondering, Ben, if you were to start a team from scratch, like what's your personal preference? Forget Sneak for a second. Imagine you were going off on your own. How would you set up the team?
I would go all in remote with occasional get-togethers. I think that's the winning formula. I mean, it all depends on the context, but if I get to choose, if I come up with my own startup idea, which most likely would be kind of tech-rooted, then I think for me it would be all remote with occasional get-togethers, and really also doubling down on the fact that maybe not the entire team needs to meet all the time, but you can meet with, say, collaboration points, right? It's like, yeah, 3-4 people that work on something critical. Why don't we just make that a few days somewhere, hash it out, and then go back and execute. But yeah, all remote. I'm convinced.
Would you hire folks geographically so it was more convenient to do that sort of thing, or would that not be a consideration?
That's something I would factor in. I would hire within a certain range of time zones. I would probably start with Europe because I'm more familiar. That's my time zone right now. And then if you scale, you can absolutely think about branching out east or west, but then kind of create clusters. I would not design teams around this kind of cross time. You know, maybe there's always exceptions. There's like the infra teams where they're actually highly beneficial because you have on-call hours that cut exceptions. But generally speaking, I would start with a time zone range, 2-3 hours, start building out a high-performing team, and then branch out and do the exact same thing east or west. And then over time, add this kind of combo where if you have a use case where it's useful to have the entire, you know, all of the time covered, then you can also have this this option.
I'm looking at the clock and we're running out of time here. And so I want to be respectful of your time and thank you for being generous with it. It's always great catching up. Before we jump, what's one question about remote work that you feel like you don't have the answer to yet?
In terms of productivity, I have a hunch we have the answers. I guess for me, the big question I don't have an answer to is, where is it going in the future? What's going to be the winning formula? Is it going to keep growing? Is it going to stagnate? It's really difficult for me to predict because Subjectively speaking, I don't see strong arguments why it wouldn't continue to grow. But then there's this political dimension around it that I find very unpredictable. Yeah. With the like return to office thing, mandates and so on. That's, I guess, just a meta question about remote work. Where's it going? I couldn't predict, even though I know it's working and I like it. But I don't know.
I think the cat's out of the bag. I don't think we're ever going back. But I do wonder, like, as an industry, obviously individuals at certain companies are in fact going back. But I think there is a question of is it going to stagnate or grow? I'm not sure. Well, thank you again, Ben, for coming
thank
on
you.
And chatting. It's always fun. If folks want to connect with you or kind of hear more about your perspective, where would you recommend they go?
Look me up on LinkedIn. I'm old fashioned. I guess that would be the best place to just shoot me a message. Always happy to chat. Also, loose conversations. Always keen to kind of hear what others are doing and discuss best ways to run high performing engineering teams.
Yeah, good deal. Well, we'll include a link in the show notes. Thank you again for the time. We'll chat soon.
Thanks so much, Jack. All the best. See you around.
Cheers.
Thanks for joining us on Distributed. If you want to learn more about what we covered in this episode, or if you want to share your own thoughts, follow @tuple on X or visit distributed.fm.